What I'd like to do now is session two, we're going to look at suffering and suffering, the sneers, the tears and the fears. I'll explain a little bit about that in a minute. So about another hour talk, hopefully. And what I'd like to do at the end, we'll switch the recording off and have a little bit of a discussion. If anyone feels able to offer any thoughts, that would be great. So I'd like to spend a bit of time looking at the TBH model a little bit more and the different components of it. And what I want to do is try and apply it directly to a few common but debilitating emotions. Because as I said before, as humans, we're neither purely biological or exclusively spiritual. We're a complex combination of body and soul. And therefore, unlike a sprained ankle, when we're looking at emotions, there's always a spiritual component to it, and we really need to acknowledge that. Proverbs 27:19 says, "As water reflects the face, so one's life reflects the heart." And as you came in this morning, in your packs on page 2, there was a little, very brief questionnaire. I don't know if you all had a chance to fill it in. If not, you've got a few minutes quickly to do it now. Don't worry if you haven't, but we'll be referring to that soon. So if you do want to quickly scribble a few things in there, you can. You don't have to tell anyone the results of that, but what I would like to do is, related to Proverbs 27:19, as water reflects the face, so one's life reflects the heart. Perhaps have a look at how your lives are reflecting your hearts. Because one of the things I really want us to take from here is applying some of this personally to ourselves. And as I mentioned in the introduction, that was a very painful process that I went through in the summer. And I'm very blessed by God for taking me through that journey. I spent quite a bit of time thinking about which emotions I should cover today because there's so many of them, and actually I can't do any of them justice really in the limited time that we've got today. So what I decided to do was rather work with clusters of emotions. And psychologically there's usually 4 cluster groups for emotions, and various people will give them different names. But the names I like, because they work for me, is the cheers, the sneers, the fears, and the tears. And the cheers are obviously those sort of emotions that perhaps we associate with Christianity. It's joy and peace and contentment and love. And we'd love as Christians, wouldn't we, to just experience these in their fullness all the time. But unfortunately, the reality for most of us is that at least at times we're going to have periods in our lives when we are more gripped by more uncomfortable emotions. And these are, firstly, the sneers. And the reason I call these the sneers is because they're really directed at or against other people. So this cluster of emotions might include, for example, irritation, frustration, anger, contempt, pride, envy, spite, jealousy, loathing, fury, resentment, maybe bitterness. The fear group of emotions includes things like dread or panic, maybe distress, nervousness, unease, feeling of being vulnerable or helpless, just feeling completely overwhelmed with life, consumed by worry, and of course at the extreme anxiety. The tears, the fourth group, are things like disappointment, hurt, despair, guilt, shame, alienation, isolation, insecurity, unhappiness, rejection, misery, and then again at the extreme, depression. So it's actually these last three, the sneers, the fears, and the tears, that I want to spend a bit of time looking at this morning. So on page 2 of your handouts, I asked you to just tick or circle 8 to 10 sort of feelings that really leapt out and spoke to you. And hopefully you managed to add up how many S, T, and F scores you obtained. And now I'm just going to explain why. Because if you look at your total scores, Maggie, can you hear me all right? Are you sure? Is that okay? Do you need the hearing aid loop going up a bit? Teresa, can the hearing aid loop go up a little bit? How's that? Is that better? Do you want to talk to Teresa? Okay, all right. Sorry. So your forms, yeah. If you had a high score, the highest score of F, this is for the fears cluster. And what this shows potentially is that the dominant filter that you view the events of your life in is one of fear. And as a result, emotionally, you're probably likely to experience an awful lot of worry and anxiety. If perhaps you scored your highest score as S, that's the sneer emotions, and this is the anger continuum, and this is dominating your filters. And if that's the case, perhaps you're likely to suffer a lot of bitterness or irritation in your relationships, or like me, building fury on lovely beach walks with your family. And maybe if it's T, this is for tears, so perhaps your dominating filter you see your life events in is one of insecurity and sadness and helplessness, and at the extreme, perhaps you experience depression. Because as experiences occur in life, what happens is we start to see ourselves being defined by them. And these mental filters build up and they build up. And then they affect the way we see subsequent events happening in our lives. So if perhaps someone has experienced extreme frustration as a child, as an adult, they might see everything through a frustrated lens. And their response to virtually everything that happens might be one of real bitterness and anger. Perhaps someone who's maybe had, sadly, an aggressive parent in childhood might, as an adult, see everything through a lens of fear, even those things that aren't really considered fearful by most other people. And of course, most importantly, the filters that we have also affect how we see God. And it's very common when we're suffering emotional difficulties for us to see God's character and our own, ourselves and others in a very distorted way. Ed Welch off from CCEF illustrates this in two really good books. They're over there if you want to have a look. And they are What Do You Think of Me and Why Do I Care? And When People Are Big and God Is Small. CCEF, really, really good organization. They're American, and a lot of the stuff I'm doing today is drawn from them. They're a really good organization. They go right to the heart. Their British counterpart is Biblical Counseling UK. They're really starting to do a lot of good work in this country. And I would really recommend any of their resources to you. But Ed Welch suggests that the heart of the matter in experiencing destructive emotions really comes down to three questions, and whether the answers for those questions are really clear in our minds. And those three questions are, who is God, who am I, and who are other people? Oh, my slides have gone a bit funny. There you go. If we've got the answer to these questions wrong, it's going to lead to us suffering destructive thoughts, behaviors, and emotions. So, for example, if we look at the first column of feeling rejected, this is obviously part of the tears cluster. And if that's the case, we're probably seeing God as someone who is far away and he doesn't care about us. We're going to see other people as people that we put our hope in, and they let us down. And as a result from that, when we look at ourselves, we feel we're nothing, we're isolated and alone. And I think, sadly, you hear of cases where there have been church splits and people have been betrayed by other Christians or people in a church environment. And I think this feeds very, very closely into that sort of experience. And it's horrible. It's really, really horrible. If we look at jealousy in the next column, this obviously is part of the sneers continuum. And we see God as someone who really should give us something that we want. We believe we're the judge and we deserve better. Maybe we think we deserve better looks or ability or life or health or whatever it is. And as a result, the way we'll treat other people is that they are below us and I deserve more than they do. In the final column, fear, obviously this is the, feeling fearful. We can see God as being angry and unloving, and we see ourselves as being very, very vulnerable and just waiting to be pushed out the nest all the time, and seeing that other people pose threats to me. So if we have these ways of thinking in our minds wrong, this is going to cause emotional suffering. And if you're personally in the grip of difficult emotions, or maybe you're helping someone who is, undoubtedly, life is going to be full of suffering. Life is going to feel really, really hard. And someone who is in the grip of these difficult emotions undoubtedly needs a huge amount of love and support. But the word sufferer here actually is really, really important, and I'll explain why. First of all, when you're trying to connect to someone who is suffering these difficult emotions, and particularly a Christian, if they are able to see themselves as a sufferer of this, it does a couple of things. First of all, you can help them to identify with parts of the Bible that so many of them specifically refer to suffering, and particularly the book of Psalms. There is so much suffering addressed in it. So we can draw them to that, and they can connect to that in a tangible way. But it also helps to highlight the temporary nature of suffering, because generally speaking, if someone is suffering very high anxiety or deep depression, it is temporary. They didn't always experience this, and usually in this life, and certainly always in the next life, we won't experience that. So suffering has a temporary nature to it, and that's an important thing for them to get in their minds. And the sufferer bit also helps to prevent them from identifying themselves as their emotional difficulty, because this can have really unhelpful cognitive implications in its own right. Their identity, if you're experiencing these emotions or helping someone, it is your identity is in Christ. The old is gone and the new has come, and you are a new creation. But it's so easy to think, actually, I'm someone who's depressed, and that becomes our identity. It isn't. Our identity is adopted as one of God's loved children. It also highlights the fact as well, and this is really, really important. It can sound harsh, but it's really important for recovery. Being a sufferer helps them to see that they have a responsibility to do something. And if you imagine, for example, that I say that I'm suffering being cold, and I'm sorry for those of you out there who've said you were cold in the last session. Hopefully the heating will be boosting out now. But if we say we're cold, we have a responsibility to do something about it. We can go and put a cardigan on, or we can go and ask someone at the church to go and turn the heating up. And as a result, those cold sensations vanish. Have I just vanished? Am I back? Yeah, I'm back. It's really crucial when we're working with people for recovery that they identify the fact that they do have a responsibility to take action to help themselves, which can feel really, really hard to hear as someone who is suffering that, as well as to gently and lovingly say to someone who is experiencing it. But it's really important to know as well that suffering difficult emotions in itself isn't a bad thing. In fact, it's psychologically very damaging to try and avoid feeling difficult emotions. Clearly, in the Bible, we're told to weep with those who weep. And other parts too suggest that there is a time and a season where experiencing difficult emotions is right. And emotional resilience is actually defined as an individual's ability to properly adapt to adversity. And if we can do that, this is actually the bedrock of positive emotional well-being. It involves trying to find positive meaning in misfortunes and difficulties. But difficult emotions only really become bad when they're felt out of all proportion to the situation, and they take over leading and controlling our lives. And if we just go back briefly to this slide by adapted from Graham Bainan's book, again, that illustrates when these emotions start taking over. And if we're so consumed with jealousy, for example, at point C, and we cannot be happy that a race that our friend has trained so hard for, and perhaps doing it for charity, but actually we're glad when they lose that race and they're disappointed, something is quite badly wrong, and that is saying something in our lives. So let's spend a bit of time looking at these clusters of emotions and applying the TBH model of thoughts, behavior, and heart to them. And what I want to do is look at how they feel, what our thoughts are doing, what's going on biologically, and most importantly, I want to have a look at maybe what's going on inside our hearts. I must say at this point, this is actually a really hard subject for me to address from the front. God has given us church community and relationships for a reason, and it's wonderful that you are all part of church communities, but I'm really aware that as I stand here at the front, actually, I don't know most of you here at all, and I just want you to be reassured, you know, I'm really not speaking harshly. Even if you believe I might be, I'm speaking in love as a sister in Christ to you. Part of the difficulty of experiencing difficult emotions is the associated distorted thinking patterns, and it's very, very easy to think you are hearing things in the light of those thoughts. But please trust me, as the Holy Spirit enables me, I'm speaking biblical truth as gently as I can, and there is no judgment, there is only love. So firstly, let's have a look at the sneers. As I said before, these are the angry emotions, and they're directed at people and against people. And you might be wondering, actually, why are you bothering covering this? Because isn't anger really something associated with testosterone-filled men? That's true, it generally is. But I've certainly met some very angry women in my time, and it is something that I struggle with a lot myself. The cluster also involves things like irritation and frustration, pride, envy, spite, loathing, bitterness, and perhaps that quiet resentment and bitterness towards others is something that you certainly do sadly see in a lot of Christian women. And these are all derivatives of anger. And over the summer, we had a lovely chap here from LTS, Duncan, who had a really good acronym for this. And he said, Christian, don't play the game, G-A-M-E, the grumbling and moaning eclipse. Because I think as Christians, it's just really catchy, it's brilliant, isn't it? When we've got this mental filter of these negative emotions going on in us, of the anger continuum, we eclipse our Christian witness. When we sit grumbling and complaining about people and having this bitterness in our hearts, it can completely eclipse Christ. So let's just have a look quickly at cognitively the thoughts of what is going on when we are experiencing these angry emotions. If you want to refer back to the list, the cognitive distortions list in your folders, in your handout packs, I'm going to be referring to some of these. So with the anger emotions, it's often all or nothing or black and white thinking. We have very rigid and extreme attitudes that lead us to speak to others unhelpfully, maybe about a person, and to help support our views. We also do a lot of mental filtering, which means we look, if somebody has annoyed us, and we look deliberately for more evidence to support us being right and the other being wrong. We're just constantly on the lookout for a malicious intent and meaning from them. We also do a lot of emotional reasoning. We think just because we feel a certain way, we feel angry, the reality of the situation must be that way. And we're very tempted to move towards labeling and personalization. So we're blaming and labeling others. Maybe we call them mean or stupid or things like that. Next, in this model, we can look at the, let me just go back to the model. Yeah, we'll just look at that. If we go back to the model, we can look at the behavioral component of it. And there are two parts to this. There's something called a behavioral component, and there's an action tendency as well. So the behavioral component is actually what we are physically doing. The action tendency is when we have a strong desire to do it, even if we actually don't. So whether it's behavioral or an action tendency, we tend to move towards seeking revenge. We might attack a person verbally or backstab them to other people. Sometimes, in an extreme, there is a physical attack, but more often, I think, with ladies, it's more recruiting allies against each other. It's that unhelpful gossip that we're told about so much in the Bible, in Proverbs, and in the book of James in particular. It's manipulating situations and being critical or judging. It's just a more passive form of anger. And I think particularly as women, we are very skilled at doing withdrawal and sulking and the cold, silent treatment, along with that I'm fine through gritted teeth. These are all outward demonstrations of this emotional cluster. And biologically, as I said earlier, all emotions will cause a biological change in our bodies by stimulating the nervous system. And this cluster of emotions is really stimulating the fight component of the flight or fight response we looked at earlier. And it's true to say, like everything in life, you know, the biology affects people differently as well. So while some people will absolutely blow up at the slightest provocation and the increase in their physiology, others can seem to tolerate a huge amount of being pushed and pushed before an external response is noted by other people. But whatever is going on outwardly, it's true to say our heart has increased, our heart rate has increased, our blood pressure has gone up, our brains have had all the blood flood to them for a far more focused thought on what's happening, and that's why that expression seeing red, you know, when you're really angry at something, everything is focused on that one thing and person that's annoyed you. Perhaps road rage is a really good example of this. But it's really important, I think, to make the point that not all anger is bad or sinful. So we're told in Ephesians 4:26, in your anger, do not sin. Of course, our natural tendency in this fallen world, isn't it, that we do sin in our anger. But this verse clearly implies it is possible to be angry without sinning. And I think we see from looking at examples in the Bible from Jesus, he clearly experienced sinless anger. For example, in the temple, as he drove out those who'd made the house of God into a den of thieves. What's really important, though, when we're experiencing anger is our heart motives and our reaction to this physiological arousal state. For example, do we go and seek revenge? Do we lash out verbally? Maybe as women, again, we give the hard shoulder. Maybe we just withdraw from situations and we become bitter. These are all passive forms of anger. There's always a tendency in anger to blame other people or circumstances. He made me do it. She drove me crazy and I just exploded. I'm sorry, this is incorrect. Because as I gave with the spider example, two people can be confronted with exactly the same provocation. And yet one can respond biblically and motivated by grace, and the other can respond motivated by flesh. And undoubtedly, through this cluster of emotions, many relationships will suffer. And that includes our relationship with God. But also, make no mistake, the perpetrator of the anger is suffering greatly too. Living with bitterness or hostility is a really horrible place to be. But most of our anger is sinful, isn't it? Before I was converted, I had a very bad temper. I was a real thermometer rather than a thermostat. So unlike a thermostat that goes up and up and then has a nice switch-off mode, I didn't have that. I was very much a thermometer, and I would go up and up and up and up, and I would yell and throw things an awful lot. Sadly, our backgammon board never recovered an unfortunate end to a marital board games evening. But I'm really thankful that through Christ, I have been given self-control as the fruit of the Spirit. And while sometimes I struggle to use it, it is rare for my explosion to happen. But it's also true to say that actually inside, I regularly suffer that inner rage just boiling away inside me. And it's horrible. It's a horrible thing to experience. It's really painful to manage. It's really exhausting. And it's hard, really hard to deal with in a constructive way. I don't like talking about it with friends or with God. And I can feel really, really confused, and it causes me sometimes to lack assurance. How can I be a Christian when I feel this angry so much of the time, particularly if I know I'm causing others to suffer as well? I think it's also true to say that out of these emotional clusters, the three emotional clusters we're looking at, the sneers are maybe the most difficult to bring around change in, because often the bitter and resentful spirit just grows slowly and it festers away. We don't realize the impact that really we're having on others, because the snipes and attacks that we do on others, and perhaps the fear of a more of an explosion, makes people rather intimidated, and they're not very likely to tell us about it. In the mind of someone who's angry, you're always right and everybody else is wrong, and we completely believe we're justified in thinking and acting that way. And actually, behaviourally, the sneers are quite an effective way of working, sadly, because people do tiptoe around you because they never know what to expect from you. They're fearful of the cold shoulder treatment. And this then acts as a behavioural reward, because those that experience the sneers often get what they want a lot of the time, because people are tiptoeing away. But it's a very, very unhealthy way spiritually and physically to have our relationships. Perhaps the only hint to people that there's a problem is they only have a very, very small, tiny group of friends. Maybe coffee mornings rapidly draw to a close when they arrive because the atmosphere changes so much. People are driven away, but they only remain polite and superficial with them. So it's really, really, really important to look at what is going on in the heart. And that's why I have it at the center of the TBH model, because this is where we get down to the nitty-gritty of the matter. Because anger, the sneer cluster, is really the most important pointer as to what is really important to the real you that only God sees, until it obviously explodes or bubbles over in public. And again, to quote Ed Welch, he observes very wisely, I think, when in doubt, look at what's going on inside you. Because as Proverbs 27:19 tells us, as water reflects the face, one's life reflects the heart. So what is really dominating the heart when we're angry? What is that heart matter? Well, it's me, basically. It's the heart that says my personal rule or standard has been violated or threatened or blocked in some way. It's seeing a perceived transgression against yourself, and it's a heart of pride. It puts me at the center of everything and above everybody else, including God. And of course, our response to this, of us being blocked, is we actively punish people. Maybe we overtly yell at them, or maybe we more covertly backstab or are critical about them in our speech to them or to others. And the way we treat people really mirrors the condition of our hearts, because in these anger clusters, deep down, really, we prefer to sit in judgment than in mercy. And that's not just over the big things, but the really little things too, the snub, the sarcasm, the wounded pride. If we think of all those areas, perhaps, that we quietly try to punish other Christians for the hurts that usually they've unknowingly inflicted on us, what we're trying to do is demand a second payment for an offence that's already been paid for by Christ's death on the cross. But what right do we have to demand a double payment? We're trying to remove God's perfect judgment from him, and we're trying to do it ourselves. We can't. Because at the heart of the cross, if we're in Christ, it isn't about us anymore. It's all about him. When we show unrighteous anger because someone's hurt us, it isn't about me anymore. God is actually the more injured party. We see in Psalm 51, when David had committed adultery with Bathsheba, David says, against you, God, only have I sinned. And when we look at the cross, instead of seeing someone else's failings and their sins against us, what we should actually be seeing is our own sin against God. Tim Chester says in another really good book, you can change over there, that good and righteous anger, the anger that Jesus showed, is a controlled emotional response to the right things. And those right things are sin and justice. And it's done in the right way, so it's controlled, and it's desiring good. It's always full of mercy. It's constructive. And it's always delivered with patience, forgiveness, acceptance, and encouragement in a way that you continue in that relationship. It doesn't end. So much of our sinless anger just ends a relationship, doesn't it? I'm really sorry if this sounds harsh, but we really do need to examine our hearts. If we're in this cluster of emotions, God is saying something to that. Can I really encourage you, if any of this has spoken to you, as it did to me very much when I was writing it, please submit that part of your heart over to God and let him show you how he wants you to change. Secondly, let's then have a look at the fears. I think a really good acronym for this, fears, false evidence appearing real, which is, I think, a really good summary of what this cluster is all about. Because these are emotions that are rooted in, it's always future-orientated thinking, and it always incorporates themes of threat or danger that leave you feeling very vulnerable. They'll leave you feeling with a real sense of unease about an uncertain outcome. And as I've said before, it might this cluster involves panic, nervousness, vulnerability, helplessness, apprehension, and worry, and at the extreme anxiety. And I would say, I think now, severe anxiety disorders probably make up the majority of all the Christians I'm working with at the moment. And obviously, at an extreme of anxiety, we see things like phobias, panic attacks, eating disorders, OCDs, obsessional compulsive disorders, and GAD, generalized anxiety disorder, and of course, self-harming. These are all extreme versions of anxiety. And I think not just within the Christian community, but nationally, it's something that we're starting to experience in epic proportions. And I think it's only going to rise. So again, looking at the cognitive, the thought side of it, what's actually happening, again, it's having a very, very rigid or extreme attitude. It's all or nothing and black and white thinking. And when we go into mental filtering, what we've done is we're increasing those threat-related thoughts to us, and we're reducing those sensible thoughts to increase the threat. Magnification as a way of thinking will cause us to look for more and more evidence to overestimate that threat that we believe there is. And we're very eager to get into emotional reasoning because we feel the situation is fearful. It must be fearful rather than looking at the reality of the situation. I think something that is very, very common in this cluster of emotions is mind reading and fortune telling. We absolutely believe we know what people are thinking about us. We know it will always be the worst possible thought. And we also know what the situation is going to be. It's going to be the worst possible outcome for us. So we find ourselves disqualifying the positive. We believe that we aren't as capable as we are to cope with the threat. So this way of thinking obviously leads again to a behavioral or an action tendency response. And the responses that we see coming out in this are avoidance behaviors or controlling behaviors, repetitive behaviors, and also, sadly, attempts to really numb this very, very difficult emotional sensation. So that might be through drugs or alcohol or maybe self-harming. And it becomes a much more increasingly restrictive lifestyle for people who are constantly needing to seek reassurance, and it often results in disturbed sleeping patterns and disturbed eating patterns. Undoubtedly, you will be feeling absolutely exhausted and a low mood, and you may just dread things all the time. These are all sort of outward demonstrations of this emotional cluster. Again, if we look biologically at what's going on, again, any thought like this will cause a biological effect in the body. And this group of emotions is the flight component of the flight or fight response. Again, so our heart rate is rising, our blood pressure is going up, thoughts become focused, but only in a very tiny area. We'll have an incredibly tight stomach because our blood supply is diverted away to other organs, so IBS symptoms will be greatly aggravated. We won't be able to eat because our digestive system isn't working properly. You might have palpitations, trembling, sweating, very cold, clammy hands, and maybe dizziness as well. Overbreathing is very, very common in this. Just as a guideline, it's quite useful, I think, to sit quietly and count how many breaths you're breathing. 15 to 20 is a very healthy guideline for that. If it's going up more, 20 to 30, almost certainly you're dramatically overbreathing, which is very common in this. And what is happening is your blood gases are very, very different. You're hyperventilating, and that will cause sensations like dizziness and things like that, which can be frightening in their own right. But just like the angry emotions, it's also true to say that not everything on the spectrum of fear is actually a problem, because there's a right fear as well. If something is happening in us to give us a sensation of fear, it could be showing a healthy concern. And of course, it's right, isn't it, that if we maybe are facing an uncertain health diagnosis, or maybe a new business we've set up is unlikely to survive an initial cash flow problem. It's right. Fear, we should feel fearful, and fear equips us to take action where we can. It can alert us perhaps to the need for test all things, maybe about a relationship or about friends or a church situation. We need to have wisdom and discernment about these things, and fear is a very, very good emotion to alert us to these, the need to test against all things. Again, just like the anger emotions, they only become an issue when they take over everything and everything is seen in a fear filter, even when self-protection isn't actually necessary. So most of the fears that we experience actually are bad. And they really, really do regularly escalate way beyond what is a healthy concern. We're looking for certainty when actually there is no certainty. And when that happens, bad actions appear, a complete certainty. And it's a way of thinking that really reveals our vulnerabilities. And you see it in different ways. If you've got worry, for example, the worry thought just goes round and round and round in your mind all the time. And what's happening with that really is the more you're doing that, actually you're far less equipped to do anything practical to deal with that issue that's causing you worry. As you go further up the spectrum, what you start getting is anxiety and it just taking over and taking over. And then at the extreme of anxiety, out come the panic attacks, for example. So a panic attack is a full-blown attack which believes that the fear of something catastrophic is going to happen right now. There's usually acute dread and terror that happens, and often whatever the feared event is will form a very, very strong mental image in your mind. And this is often how phobias start happening, and this real or imagined fear will just take over as a mental image, giving rise to panic attacks. This was, I was working in London when the bombs went off on the tubes, and one of the issues that came off the back of that was many people would not travel on the tubes for many, many months afterwards, and the panic attacks of being stuck in a tunnel were just too great for people to contemplate bearing. And it's true to say when someone comes for help in this area, often what they're actually coming to seek help for is to have clarification that you can change their circumstances or change other people in their lives. Rarely do people come to you acknowledging their need for heart change. And many people suffering from this cluster of emotions really stall in therapy because they're so fearful. They're unable to take those steps out of their comfort zone and to increase that exposure to their fears to help them to let go and to trust and move on. And this is why, again, getting to the heart is so important. So let's have a look at what is dominating the heart when we're anxious. What is the heart matter? Again, I don't want this to sound harsh. Please don't take this the wrong way, but it needs to be said. It's a heart that is lack of trust, and it's a heart that wants to control. So it'll be different for all of us. Maybe it's our job, our possessions. Maybe it's our money. Maybe we're frightened of losing our health. Maybe we're frightened of other people. And I think, actually, this is probably one of the biggest ones, fear of others. What might people say to us? What might they think about us? Will they reject us? But the bottom line is, whatever these fears are, it's a heart that refuses to fully trust God. You're looking to yourself or others as the object of trust instead of God. We know as a Christian, when we're saved, the Holy Spirit will permanently reside in our hearts. God will never leave us or forsake us. But in that heart, we've sort of got the Holy Spirit crushed up into this corner. We're grieving the Spirit whilst we try to control the rest of our heart that way. And I would really recommend, if this is speaking to you, Ed Welch's When I'm Afraid, which is on there, is a really, really good workbook addressing fear and anxiety, and particularly the fear of provision, others, or health. It's a really helpful book. But in this, he makes a big point of stating that the manner of the Old Testament that we see God providing for the Israelites on that long journey through the wilderness is actually God's grace of the New Testament, because just like we saw for the Israelites, God provided exactly what they needed when they needed it. And he does that through his grace now. Because if we're viewing potentially tomorrow's troubles without God's grace, of course we're going to be worried and we're going to be afraid. Corrie ten Boom in The Hiding Place illustrates this beautifully, I think, when she went through time as a young girl of feeling absolutely terrified about the prospect of death. And she writes this lovely story about her talking to her dad about it. And her dad very wisely says to her, "Corrie, when you're about to get on a train for a train journey, when do I give you the ticket? Is it a week before?" "No, I wouldn't do that, because you'd lose it. I give it to you the moment you're about to get on the train." And this is exactly what God does. He gives us the grace we need to cope in a difficult situation exactly when we need that grace, and not a moment too soon. Richard and I experienced this personally for ourselves about 6 years ago when I was pregnant with our third child, Kezi. And at 32 weeks pregnant, I was taken into hospital with my placenta rupturing, and we were kept in hospital right next to theatre for the next 6 weeks. And that was frightening. But what I can also say is that we were given God's grace at exactly the time we needed to have that grace. And he held us through it in seeing lots of people around us in the grip of heightened emotion. We could say, no, we can feel God so close to us during this moment. And at one particular time, whilst in hospital, I had another very serious hemorrhage and had the whole sort of medical team around preparing me for surgery, trying to get the baby's heartbeat. And I remember distinctly thinking, I'm going to die. This is what it feels like to be dying. Without wanting to be too graphic, but there was blood going everywhere on the floor. They were trying to get needles in, but I had no veins. And it was horrible. It was terrifying. And in that moment that I thought, I want to be a wife and I want to be a mum, but it doesn't look as if that's going to be the case, I thought, I'm going to shut my eyes and I'm going to open them and see Jesus as the first thing I look at. And I was able to hold out my hand and think of the verse, "For I am the Lord your God who takes hold of your right hand and says, do not fear, I will help you," from Isaiah 41. And in that moment, my heart rate regulated, the hemorrhage stopped. I know that doesn't always happen, and I'm very thankful to say in this case it did. But that peace from God came over me in that moment, and he gave me that grace to deal with that moment at exactly the moment I needed it. And I'm very thankful to say, obviously, I'm here today, and we have a wonderful little girl, Kezzy, as well. But God gives us that grace we need, and not a moment too soon. But I think often when we're in the grip of anxiety, instead of fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, we look to ourselves to control, don't we? And instead of walking that narrow path straight on, we become trapped in a bit of a Christian cul-de-sac. That isn't my expression, it's someone else's, and I can't remember whose it is, so sorry, whoever that person is that said that expression. But we just go round and round in this Christian cul-de-sac, just like the Israelites in the wilderness did. Let me just flip on a few slides. This, I think, is a really helpful diagram about anxiety, because it's not rocket science to know that we'll feel the most stress and anxiety when we feel out of control of a situation. But as Christians, I think this should really sit very comfortably with us, because whilst we know that God will equip us with all the things we need to fulfill his purpose in us, only he controls things. We don't have total control, only he does. But we do have access to prayer, to the creator of the world, the sustainer of our next breath, and he is in complete control. We're told in Romans 8:28, we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him and who have been called according to his purpose. So it's really important, I think, if we look at this diagram a second, the column in the middle is a situation where we're unable to control anything, but we're also unable to let go. And obviously we're going to experience very high anxiety if this is the way we're seeing things. But God has equipped us, hasn't he, that if there are things that we can do about a situation to help it, we should do it. And as we come along here, as we do put those things into practice and attempt to control things within our ability that God has equipped us to do, the stress levels, anxiety levels will come down. But it's also true as well that as Christians, we can trust in a God who is in perfect control. And I really don't mean this in a irreverent or a flippant way, but the expression "let go and let God" while we are be still and knowing that he is God is a really healthy way of thinking and behaving, because as we also let go and let God, our anxiety levels drop as well. So it comes from two different things. There are things that we will never understand in our lives because we're not God. But I think in a society where we have the internet and things like that, and that's great, you know, we have this hunger and thirst for knowledge and this belief that we can control everything, and we can't, because God can, and God meant it to be that way. So let's now just have a look at the tears. So this is a theme of emotions that are obviously rooted in loss and self-devaluation. And again, they tend to take us very, very far away from people and things. And it's true to say that anxiety and depression are very, very closely related. It's very common for someone who is initially experiencing anxiety to go on to become depressed. Again, these are the flight part of the flight or fight response. But in addition to that, there's also the freeze response. And I think we sometimes see this in someone who's depressed. They are so gripped in it, this frozen state of which they can just do nothing. I can't do depression justice in the very short period of time I have this morning, but for the purpose of just this little bit here, I am actually going to primarily talk about depression. So again, if we look at the thoughts and thoughts component of it, It's the what's the point based thinking, which is so bleak and despairing. And it's indecisive and it's ruminating thoughts going round and round. Again, the type of distortions that happen are all or nothing thinking. It tends to be directed at us or at God, that I shouldn't be feeling this way. I must not feel this way. What's wrong with me? What's the point? It's mental filtering. We only see negative aspects of loss or failure, and it's emotional reasoning. We believe because we feel helpless and the situation is bleak that it must be helpless. We can't see any positives there, so the future looks so bleak and no hope. And there's a lot of overgeneralization that goes on that says, I'm rubbish, what's the point? Why do I even exist? Again, it's mind reading, it's having negative predictions about the hopelessness of the future, and it's jumping to conclusions about what that future will be. It's a very, very highly critical thinking of failure or setbacks for ourselves and of others. And this negative thinking pattern just keeps going around in a very, very vicious cycle. So behaviorally, a lot of the tendencies are very similar to that of anxiety, but they're far more bleak and they're far more pronounced. And as the sufferer sort of withdraws more and more from things that they've previously found enjoyable and deeply, deeply go into themselves, this reinforces their depressive state. So there's a loss of pleasure and interest in everything. And also our libido and our appetite and motivation are all significantly reduced. And from that also comes extremely low confidence. And I think for Christians as well, perhaps the saddest bit of all of this is that God just seems a million miles away. Ben, the pastor here, his brother is a psychotherapist, and I believe he does a lot of work with teen depression. And he's recently released a video on YouTube where a lot of these teens are talking about their experience of depression. And something that really struck me, one of the youngsters in this video said, trying to describe their depression to someone is like trying to explain to them a color they've never seen. And I think that really just shows the reality of depression. Trying to explain how you are feeling to someone is like trying to illustrate a color that this person has never seen. And it's also true to say that whilst at one level there are very common factors in depression, it's also true to say that every person will suffer differently and greatly. And I really want to really emphasize again at this point, if you have been prescribed medication for a depression from your GP, please do not just suddenly stop taking it. It can have really, really serious complications. Even if you feel fed up with taking them yourselves, please just don't suddenly stop taking them. So biologically, again, sleep patterns are disturbed or poor. We have muscle weakness. Weight changes can change dramatically, either increase or decrease. Again, heart, blood pressure issues, a fuzzy brain, partly due to the medication, partly due to the thought processes. Again, tight stomach, palpitations, breathlessness, trembling, sweaty. At one level, there's such a nothingness and horribleness about depression, there's such bleakness and loss and despair, but in another sense, it's just so full of everything and messiness and noise and thoughts and physical sensations. But if we just step back slightly from depression for a moment, it's also important to know that, like the other clusters of emotions, not everything identified in this spectrum of tears is bad, even when that is extreme sadness. Because even extreme sadness, and perhaps the sadness we see most profoundly when there's been a bereavement loss, is a right way of dealing with that situation. Obviously, bereavement is a truly, truly terrible and horrible time for that person, but it's also true to say that it doesn't usually turn into despairing because the loss is accepted as irrevocable. So there's a healthy way of experiencing very, even very, very real and deep sadness. And usually time and support and love will help someone in extreme sadness to just travel that really, really hard journey. And it would still be considered a normal grief response, however devastatingly hard that is to endure when you're going through it. But gradually, it is true, even in very deep sadness, enjoyment of life does return. And in fact, one of the things you see with people suffering bereavement is the guilt that they feel at in their own mind, feeling happy too quickly, or finding themselves laughing at things in life quite soon after the bereavement. But in contrast, if we look at the bad side of things, depression clearly doesn't fall into this category. Depression is never good. It's a very severe illness. And it's also true to say it will always have an impact of thoughts that are distorted in some way. It's a negative, what's called negative triad of thinking. So there's a negative view of yourself, of the world, and of the future. And I know it's true to say that there is an organic cause of depression in terms of chemical imbalances in the brain. As I say, I can't go into the intricacies of that at the moment because it's very complicated. But just to view depression as a chemical imbalance is completely inaccurate, because what you always find in depression is very strong evidence of these negative thinking patterns. And one of the side effects of negative thinking patterns is a reduction in the chemical hormones in the brain. So it's a cycle that goes on. And if we're only taking antidepressants and not looking at what's going on in our thinking patterns, and most importantly, our heart, the increase in these chemical increase in the neurotransmitters in our brain will be being reduced by the negative thinking patterns that are going on. And when we have this filter, this mental filter going on in depression, let me just illustrate a bit what it's like. If I say to all of you, as you go out from here and have your journeys home, can you please count how many blue cars you see on your journey home? And then I ring you up later on this evening and I say, how many silver cars did you see on your journey home? Partly I think I'm going to get a really puzzled response from you, but you'll almost certainly agree with me that there were silver cars that you went past on your journey home, but you didn't think they were relevant, so you didn't acknowledge them in any way. Your brain has completely filtered out that information. The only thing that you've been focused on is the blue cars I asked you to look at. And this is a bit like the cloud that happens in depression. It's this filter on all our thoughts that only brings to the mind the emotion that we're experiencing and the memories to support that thinking as well. So we're constantly in this cycle of recalling very, very unpleasant memories that show us how we felt a failure or how people have hurt us through the comments. It's all seen in that way. So, of course, people struggling this way, they need love, they need patience, they need empathy, and they really, really need prayer. And they need to be encouraged to pray themselves, and that's really hard. And liturgy, sort of a short written prayer, is really helpful for this. But they need to also be encouraged to have faith and to cry out to God. And they need us to do that when they can't. They need very, very serious, committed engagement from us. And just like the sneers and the tears, sneers and fears, in the tears there's also a heart matter that's going on at a very deep level. And it can be more complicated to pinpoint the heart matters in depression, partly because often it has come from severe anxiety. But undoubtedly, what is common in the heart of all those experiencing depression is a very, very deep loss. And that loss is actually often a response of something that's really good, but wanting that thing to the wrong degree. And when we want that thing to the wrong degree, when we lose it or we don't have it, we feel that loss very, very deeply. I think generally in all of these emotions, we see trials as things to be avoided at all costs, and we pray for those trials to be removed from ourselves and for others that we love. But undoubtedly, God uses trials, including the suffering of deep depression, to bring about transformation into the likeness of Jesus. And actually, this is God's ultimate plan for us. God isn't like us in that he's not just a bigger, better version of us. He's bigger and better and more loving and everything in ways that we could ever, ever imagine. I think sometimes we can get angry at God for not being our fairy godfather and waving a magic wand and making the depression disappear. But if we're doing that, what we've actually done is humanized him. We've made him a God that's just that bit more bigger and powerful than us, wanting the same things we want. But God is a holy God, and he wants us to become more holy too. He wants this so much for us that he might ask us even to walk that very, very dark, bleak, and walk through depression to show us that whatever that loss is, whatever that loss is, and that it's causing us so much pain, he can actually provide us with so much more than that. And it's definitely true to say that there are other factors that contribute to how we feel every day, our childhood, our upbringing, our health, and perhaps especially for women, I think hormones obviously play a part in there, as does culture and personality. But as gently as I can possibly say it, we also have a choice and a responsibility. And sometimes the distress of emotional brokenness just stops us doing that as much as we have in the past or could do. But it's really important to grasp that however much you feel, God hasn't left you, even if you feel he has. And he loves you, even if you feel that he doesn't. And he's calling through that very, very dark walk to show you that loss that you're feeling in your heart. I know that might have been really hard for some people, particularly if you've experienced or are experiencing depression, but it's the heart matter. So in the next session, what I want to look at is the raging battle that is going on inside our hearts, but I hope what I will also show you is we're not fighting it alone, and there's real hope because we have God's Holy Spirit personally residing in our hearts to help us on that very dark journey. Teresa, can we have the recording off now, please? Thank you.